Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 1st of February, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of the week, and that means we are here to look back over the week's news of what's been happening in Britain. That means myself, and of course it also means my co-host here today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning. Good day to you as well. I'm doing very well, actually. I'm continuing to do what I advocated that people should do last week, which is to continue to remain active, not to allow lockdown to make you become sort of indolent and sit around doing nothing. I think that it's a good time to keep fit. I've been continuing to weight train, continuing to cycle during the course of the week, so I'm keeping myself healthy that way, and also continuing to eat healthily. And I think that this is a good time, if you've not done it before and you've got a bit more time on your hands than you normally would do, to experiment with some cooking, where you are cooking from first principles. So one of the tendencies of recent decades has been to, you know, as we lead busy lives, for us to eat more and more convenience foods, which obviously contain all sorts of odd chemicals and things that are designed to make them easy to produce and easy to heat up and in a microwave and that kind of thing. And it's good for people, now that we've got a bit more time on our hands, if you are furloughed or anything of that sort, to use that time usefully and to start cooking from first principles, so that you make sure that the food that you're eating is nourishing food. And as I said last week, also keep your mind active as well, and take up a new hobby, learn to speak a foreign language, learn to play musical instruments, that kind of thing.
Yeah, lots of people have been learning to play musical instruments. I was actually snowed in last week. After we were saying, oh, isn't it lovely, look at this beautiful snow, I was actually snowed in all the way up until Wednesday. So perhaps it wasn't so good after all. Again, we've got corona news this week. We'll get into that in a minute. But I believe you've been looking at some corona statistics, some rather interesting statistics, Max.
That's right. I occasionally have a look at unusual websites just for unusual bits of information. And I came across an article that's on the Syrian government website which is called SANA. And the on their particular website, they mentioned that there'd been a government move to increase the precautions that they're taking against COVID-19 infection. And this article was dated in December. It was December the 14th. That's a month or so old now. But the point is, they were only at that point instituting the compulsory wearing of face masks in public places, in indoor public places, basically. So markets and places of work and on public transport, that kind of thing. So I just wondered to myself, because we haven't heard anything, we tend to hear about the coronavirus statistics for various countries around in Europe and North America, and you know, to some extent South America and New Zealand, places of that sort. But we very rarely hear about anything in the Middle East. We very rarely hear anything about Africa or anything of the sort. And so I just thought I'd take a look at the statistics that were available. And so I did a bit of research, and it turns out that as far as Syria is concerned, Syria has got a population of 17.5 million. So it is roughly, it's just a bit less than a third the population of Britain. And so you would think that, you know, we've had 100,000 plus deaths from coronavirus. So I was expecting for Syria to have something like 30,000 deaths from COVID-19. And when I looked at the statistics that were available, it showed that they've only had 911 deaths from COVID-19, which I think is staggering, isn't it? And the main difference between the way in which, of course, the Syrian government have reacted to COVID-19 compared with our government here in the UK is that they closed the borders. And so everybody entering Syria from a foreign country has to take a COVID-19 test, and they're not allowed in if they test positive, or they have to go into quarantine until they're no longer infectious before they're allowed in. And that was one of the things that they've done. And when you think about Syria being a large parts of Syria just being desert. And so therefore there are long borders that Syria's got with Turkey, long borders that Syria's got with Iraq, where there is no physical barrier at all, and people could just drive across from one country to another. The fact that the Syrians have been able to control the spread of coronavirus to that extent, I think is just about remarkable. And some people might say, but Syria's got quite a large country compared to the population. And so it's got a low population density compared with the UK. And that's true. The population density in Syria is 306 people per square mile, whereas it is for the UK, 701 people per square mile. So their population density is half of ours. But then you've got to bear in mind that most people in Syria aren't going to be living in the desert. Most people are going to be living in the actual cities. And so the argument of low population density doesn't really apply. But that then made me think about, well, what about the Lebanon, which is right next door to Syria? And Lebanon have got a population of just under 7 million. But their population density is higher than the population density of Britain. They've got population density of 1,450 people per square mile, and yet the number of COVID-19 cases in Lebanon has been 298,000, and the number of deaths is 3,031. So just 441 per million of the population, compared with Syria's 52 per million of the population, and compared with Britain's 1,555 per million of the population. And so those statistics are really quite interesting. And also, we were speaking last week about Belarus. And if you look at Belarus, they've got a population of 9.5 million, population density of 118 people per square mile. So a low population density, admittedly, but number of cases, 244,000, number of deaths, 1,698, making it 179 people per square mile, roughly a tenth of the death toll that has occurred here in the UK. And so whilst there are some excuses for the way in which COVID-19 has been allowed to ravage the country, I don't think that those excuses entirely absolve the go anywhere near it absolving the politicians in this country. And it's just interesting the different approaches that different governments have had. And we mentioned last week the way in which President Lukashenko of Belarus had basically said that the best defense against coronavirus was for the people of Belarus to get out into the fields and work in the open air, and that if they started to feel the symptoms of coronavirus, for them to just drink more vodka. And it seems that that sort of an approach in a country like Belarus has actually produced a better result than all of the panicking and all of the hand-wringing, etc., and the scaremongering that's been going on here in the UK.
Well, I also think in Belarus he's refused to wear masks, and the point you were making earlier about how Syria is now only just wearing masks, and I'm wondering whether that is because they want to get their hands on that money from the World Bank and the IMF that tried to bribe Lukashenko with a huge, great loan if he would lock the country down and tell everyone to wear masks. And I'm wondering whether Bashar al-Assad is looking at maybe getting some money from the government, and maybe that's why he's recommended people wear masks. But it tends to show that somewhere along the line, these numbers aren't adding up. Either they're not adding up in the Lebanon and Belarus and Syria, and they're not counting enough people that have got COVID, or in Britain, they're counting people that haven't actually died of COVID, and they're saying that they have. I mean, the way they count the numbers up in Britain, they say anybody that dies within 28 days of testing positive for COVID. And you could have died of anything. You could have died of falling off a ladder, you could have died of a motorcycle accident, could have died of having some other underlying illness that's not really related to the COVID, and they're still being marked down as COVID statistics. So perhaps the way that they're recording these statistics in Syria and Belarus and Lebanon, perhaps they're being a little more accurate, that somebody has actually died from COVID. Maybe they found some way of proving that. We're also hearing in the Middle East there about the vaccines. Apparently, the Palestinians aren't being allowed to have a vaccine, and the Israelis aren't allowing them to have a vaccine. And I do wonder what the COVID situation will be like there, because they've got possibly the highest population density on earth is in Palestine. But the Lebanon is very near to that as well, because that's full of Palestinian refugees. So you would imagine that if they didn't have that much of a problem with it, where they're really, really packed in, dense, then we have no excuse for what is going on here in Britain at the moment. I did find it interesting last week. The EU were complaining about the vaccines. And since we left the EU, we're really leading the world in the number of vaccinations that we've actually been able to do, because we did our deals on the basis of Britain doing a deal with the vaccine manufacturers. The countries within the EU said that they would put their lot in with Ursula von der Leyen and allow her to make the deal. And of course, she's messed the deals up. They haven't got the vaccines on time, and they're now trying to muscle in on the contracts that we made, which we made 3 months before the EU made their contracts with the vaccine providers. And because the vaccine providers have said, well, look, we have to provide the ones we promised to Britain first, because they were first in the queue, the EU decided that what they were going to do in response to that is put a hard border in Northern Ireland, exactly the one thing that they had been complaining about and saying it couldn't possibly ever happen. Britain couldn't possibly leave the EU because it would mean a hard border. If there was a hard border, then that would be it, and there would be fines, and it was all going to be impossible. And then and they were all talking about the backstop. That's what this backstop was. We can't possibly have this backstop. And incredibly, it turns out to be the EU that actually did that, and they didn't tell Northern Ireland about it. They didn't tell Ireland about it. They didn't tell anybody about it. They just announced that this is what they were going to be doing. And then, of course, when there was a huge uproar, they walked it back. They're just incredible two-facedness there from the EU, and a lot of very, very embarrassed Remainers to have seen that happen after complaining so much about the fact that there was going to be this border in Northern Ireland, and we couldn't possibly have that. Just to think that it was the EU that did that, it really shows you what they are like, I think. Did you notice this? I bet it made you laugh a little bit seeing that, didn't it, Max?
I did have a chuckle about that, yes. And it was quite clear during the course of the negotiations of the exit treaty, and also during the negotiations for the trade agreement with the European Union, that they had used the border with Northern Ireland, that they'd used the Northern Ireland troubles, they'd weaponized that issue in order to undermine the negotiating position of the British government. We constantly weakened our negotiating position by constantly saying that that they couldn't agree to things that we were asking for, because it would weaken the position with regard to the Northern Ireland treaty, and yet here they are weaponizing that very same issue when it suits them, wanting to impose what would have had to have been a hard border in order to suit them when the situation was different. So again, it just sort of shows the rank hypocrisy of the European Union, and the fact that the European Union is a spiteful organisation, really. And that spitefulness also was shown during the negotiations for the exit treaty, and also for the trade agreement. It's one of the things which I think is a shameful aspect of the way in which the European Union politicians have behaved. The other thing as well is that when you look at these statistics that I mentioned just slightly earlier on, one of the things that becomes very clear is that having a low population density is a good thing. You know, in this, to use the sort of the woke terminology, in this global village that we're now living in, where nobody's safe until everybody's safe, one of the things that keeps everybody safe in a country is being spaced out, and there being plenty of space between them and their neighbour, etc. And so this whole thing demonstrates that having mass immigration into Europe is a bad thing. because by having mass immigration into Britain, what we're doing is we're increasing our population density. And in fact, you've only got to look at the various population densities around the world to see that in Europe, the population densities on average are higher for substantial countries. I'm not talking about places like Hong Kong or Singapore, which are just individual city states where the whole thing is just one metropolis. I'm talking about proper sized countries where there is some kind of a full economy there. In the countries with lower population density, the populations are protected from pandemics. And so one of the things that we ought to be thinking of in the future is, you know, if we're going to have more pandemics like this, if the coronavirus is going to start mutating so that we have to have a new vaccine every year in order to fight it off, then eventually it's going to become cheaper for us to just reduce the population of Britain. And the most logical and obvious way to reduce the population of Britain is to find ways of encouraging those people who have immigrated into Britain in recent years to go back to their home countries where the population densities are even lower than they are here. Where they will be better off in terms of protecting themselves from the virus. And in doing so, they will make us better off and help to protect us from future viruses as well.
Yeah, well, of course, if the whole point of this had actually been to save lives, then they wouldn't be doing the things that they're actually doing. And again, if the whole point of this was to save lives, then they wouldn't be keeping increasing the population density in the way that they are. They're now talking about 3 million Hong Kongese that they're going to be bringing over here, that they're giving passports so that they can come to Britain. On top of that, we have all the fake refugees that have been streaming in, particularly over the last year, and we've been housing them in hotels. And recently, just before Christmas, we started housing them in military barracks. And of course, we saw that someone tried to burn the barracks down at the one that was set up in Penally, which has caused all sorts of problems in Wales. But we also have a military barracks in Kent, which went up in flames at the weekend. 5 men have been arrested after a group of migrants set fire to the former military barracks in Kent, which had been converted into a camp for asylum seekers in the wake of massive illegal boat migration. Of course, they're fake asylum seekers. There is no war in France, so every single one of them is fake. The reason why they set fire to the barracks is because they were expecting to go to a hotel. Apparently, there had been an outbreak of coronavirus previously or somewhere else in the country, and all the fake refugees that were in those military barracks were taken off to a hotel. And a lot of these hotels they get taken to are 4-star hotels. So what happened was the fake asylum seekers that were left there were very, very disgruntled at being put into a military barracks instead of being taken off to a hotel. So they decided that they were going to set fire to it. I guess this is better than the ones that were put in a hotel in Scotland and then decided to just stab people because they weren't very happy with the quality of the food and the internet connection. These guys just set fire to the barracks. But of course, this is something that goes on and on and on, this setting fire to their accommodation. I mean, you can pretty much predict that is what is going to happen when you put them in accommodation. Max, you got any thoughts on these 5 men that were arrested after setting fire to their barracks, their accommodation?
Just that such people, by their very actions, should have excluded them from any possible consideration as immigrants to this country. The very fact that they have abused the hospitality that's been shown to them, albeit that they weren't put into a very comfortable hotel, they were put into a barrack type of situation. The fact of the matter is that they were accommodated, they were received, and that we were, as everybody knows, as far as our government is concerned, falling over themselves to accommodate the wishes of these people, and yet they still were so ungrateful that they decided to set fire to the barracks. So that should exclude them from any further consideration for migrant status, and those people should then just be immediately deported together with anybody else that, you know, stood around laughing and thinking it was incredibly funny as well. So I don't think we should just limit it to the five people who physically struck the matches to set the place on fire. I don't think that five people could have set that place on fire unless all the other people stood and sat around them had watched them do it and not intervened to stop it.
Well, I'm surprised they were arrested at all. The one that set fire to his mattress in Penally, he wasn't arrested. He was just given a talking to. These five have actually been arrested. Despite being provided with free food and accommodation at the expense of the British taxpayers, migrants in the camp have openly complained about their situation, with a group of Sudanese illegal migrants declaring that they wish they had stayed in France. Well, this is the message we need to be sending them, is that they should be staying in France, and they're not going to get free accommodation when they get here. The ones that were protesting in Penally, they even had a piece of cardboard up saying, "I need a home." They were expecting us to just provide them with housing and feed them and clothe them and all the rest. Some of them have travelled through 20 countries to get here, to the land of milk and honey, where everything is provided by the white man. And then when they get here, they're not happy that it's not good enough for them, and they haven't got white women on tap. They haven't got white women being sent into the camps for them, so they decide to set fire to them. Protests at the camp initially broke out in November, with migrants attempting to break down the barricades surrounding the facility. And of course, they are allowed out of the facility. There's no actual need for them to try and break out of the facility. More protests were staged earlier this month, despite being prohibited under the coronavirus lockdown measures. So again, nobody else can protest in the country, but they think that the law doesn't apply to them. The fire at Folkestone is reminiscent of scenes witnessed at migrant camps on continental Europe, most notably the notorious Moria camp in Greece. In September, a camp on the Greek island of Lesbos was burnt to the ground after a group of Afghan migrants set it on fire in hope of being transferred to the Greek mainland if their accommodation was destroyed. The Moria camp was home to some 13,000 migrants, despite only having a capacity of around 3,000, but the Greek government was forced to house more and more migrants at the camp as continuous waves of migrants streamed into the country. Since the opening of the Moria camp, the facility has been witness to violence and fires, often set by the migrants themselves. And last year, a record 8,400 migrants were recorded as having illegally entered the United Kingdom by boat from France, a safe non-war-torn EU member state, compared to just 1,890 the previous year. So what have we seen? We've seen a 400% increase in these illegal migrants, these fake refugees, trying to break into Britain just in the previous year. So why is this suddenly happening now? It's happening now because they know that they're not going to be sent back. They're expecting to be housed in these hotels. Priti Patel has come out quite strongly against this, but of course she's done nothing about it. She says that she's working on a new law or a new bill that will be put to Parliament later in the year, but that's no good. We've already had 8,000 last year. By the time this bill gets put to Parliament, that number could have gone up by 400% again. We could have over 30,000 arriving this year. We're just being swamped by these people. They have no right to be here, no right whatsoever to claim asylum. They're just taking advantage of us. If they're going to claim asylum anywhere, it should be in the nearest country, which is going to be somewhere like Turkey or Iraq or anywhere in Africa. Really, there are lots of countries in Africa which aren't actually at war because they're not trying to get away from war. They're just trying to get their hands on free money and white women. And they will tell you that. There are lots and lots of videos where they're just shouting about money and women and all the rest. And that's what they're expecting to find when they get it. And they're also wealthy people. They've all got smartphones. They've all managed to pay these smugglers to get them over to this country. They're not the really poor people. They are people that could very easily make a living for themselves in their own countries, but they decided they don't want to do that. And the fact that they are illegal asylum seekers and claiming asylum means that you are fleeing from some kind of law in your country. And you can claim asylum in a country that has a different law to the one in your country. And most of the time, these people are criminals in their own countries. So they're fleeing from their own countries because they've upset their countrymen. And I was told this by people in the Middle East. I went out to the Middle East some years back, and I got on very well with the people that were there. And I said, well, what are the people like that are in my country from the ones that come here from your country? And they said, don't have anything to do with them. They're all the bad guys. They're all the robbers. They're all the thieves. They're all the people that we don't want in our country. And that's why they left it to go to yours. So steer clear of them. And that comes from the horse's mouth. Max, what do you make of this migrant camp and all the other ones that have gone up in flames on the continent here?
Well, you mentioned about Priti Patel saying that she was working on a new law to combat this sort of thing. But you know, this has been going on now for decades. How long does it take to draft a law? You know, it doesn't take, you know, I could draft a law within a day and that would solve this situation, because all we need to do is to pass a law stating that the international agreements with regard to migration don't apply to people unless they're being abused in France or Iceland or Denmark, and unless those people are being persecuted in those countries, then they're not allowed in our country. It's simple as that. That would be the migrant situation sorted out in an instant. And then as far as those that are here that are causing trouble, we just simply need to pass a retrospective law that anybody who has migrated into Britain within, say, the last 50 years and who's committed an indictable offence, it should just be immediately repatriated back to their country of origin, should just be deported. And anybody that doesn't want to live here, that decides that Britain is not multicultural enough for them, then we should offer them a generous government grant to go to another country where the culture is more to their liking.
And if any of them have thrown their passports away, then we should find a country in Africa that's willing to accept funding from us and just send them back there. And say, look, we'll give you this aid if you will accept these people that have thrown their passports away. And I bet they magically remember where they're actually from, if that was actually to happen. And you can also compare this to Hungary and Serbia and other countries on the east of Europe. And they've managed to stop the migrants from coming in. They've managed to say, no, we are not accepting these fake asylum seekers. Poland has done the same. And what it seems to me is that they just come up with a different excuse every time. First off, they'll say, well, we need to have these people here because the British people don't want to do the work. And then they'll say, well, we need to have these people here because it used to be administrated by the British and now it's being administrated by Africans and they're persecuting these poor Indians, so you need to let them in. Then they say, well, we need to let them in because we have open borders in the EU and they've managed to somehow get into the EU, so we can't stop them. And now they say, well, we need to let them in because there's a war on in Syria and the war happens to be caused by us bombing the Syrians. You know, the excuse changes every time. Yeah. And the thing that remains the same is that we keep being replaced in our own country at a massive rate. Our capital city now is 60% non-white. More and more of our major cities are now becoming majority non-white, and that's what multiculturalism is. It's the replacement of our own people. We're already something like only 8% of the world's population. That is continuing to dwindle. The black African rate of the population is exploding exponentially. I mean, if you actually look at the UN predictions, I mean, it's almost going up vertical, the number of black Africans there are, and something like 60% of them all want to come to Europe. There was a poll done a couple of years back, and any government that really cares about its people is going to put a stop to this. And you don't have to be mean about it. You can offer these people grants so that they can set themselves up in their own country. You could offer them, I don't know, £10,000, £15,000 each, for each family member as well. Whole families could go back to their homeland and rebuild and build businesses, and that would still save us money in the long run. with their use of the NHS, their use of education and everything else. It's just a drain on our resources. And also it's a threat to our culture. And it's an existential threat, because when they're on our territory, breeding rights come with that territory. And each one of those that interbreeds with one of ours, all the descendants from then on are one of theirs. And that's just the way it is. We have recessive genes. We are white. If we interbreed with these people, our descendants stop being white. So it's actually an existential threat as well as an economic threat. It's a dire situation that we are in. And the best thing we can do about it at the moment, I think, is just to talk about it and ensure that we're still able to talk about it like we are doing here today, Max. I don't know if you've got anything else you'd like to add to that. Any thoughts on that before we move on to Greatest Britons?
Just that once the African immigrants and the Asian immigrants get into this country, they then start to campaign that they want to have a government in this country that looks more like them. And this is the sort of thing that you often see mentioned by spokespeople for the migrant communities, that they feel that they are second-class citizens because there's nobody in the government that looks like them, or not enough people in the government that look like them. But the fact of the matter is that if they went to Liberia or Sierra Leone, countries that were actually created to resettle the people who had been displaced as a result of the slave trade during the 1700s and 1800s, if they went to those countries, then everybody in the government would look like them, and so that they wouldn't then have that problem. Really, what it indicates is that they don't want to go to a country where the standard of living isn't as high as our standard of living, because they want to have a high standard of living handed to them on a plate, and they don't want to have to go through the process of building their own infrastructure so that they will then have a high standard of living in places like in their country of origin, or in countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone that were created specifically to resettle them, and it's just a lack of it's really just a laziness, really. It's a laziness that, if you compare the people that have come from the third world to settle in Europe today, and you compare them with the people who left Europe to go and settle in the places such as North America, etc. North America was just a wilderness, and the people that left Europe to go and settle in North America didn't go to North America because they wanted to have homes handed to them on a plate, because they wanted to have jobs handed to them on a plate, because they wanted to have all the benefits of a high technology culture handed to them on a plate. They went to resettle a wilderness, and they settled the wilderness, and they created a civilization, and they created a high technology society there. But the people that want to come to Britain from the third world, or from Africa, etc., they very often want to come to Britain just purely because they want something handed to them on a plate, something they don't have to work hard for over generations in order to achieve by the sweat of their own brow and by their own hand. And we shouldn't really continue to have sympathy for people like that. We should just tell them to go and do it for themselves.
Well, our people that went over to America, they were pioneers. You know, as you say, it was a wilderness. They went out there to tame the wilderness. They didn't go out there just to take what had already been provided for them over there. Of course, if they went back to their own homelands, they would also find that history was told from their point of view, because they're continually trying to change our history, again, which is another important reason why we cover history in this Real Britannia podcast, and why we talk about our Greatest Britons. And we've got a particularly good Greatest Briton to talk about today. We're going to be talking about Enoch Powell, and I really don't remember Enoch Powell very much. I remember having an old employer who first told me about him and said that he was the best politician that we ever had. And he made a famous speech called the Rivers of Blood speech, and everybody in Britain supported this man. But the media and the politicians were against him. And if only. And when we look into his history, he wasn't just famous for this speech. He was another incredibly intelligent man that was well known for giving fantastic speeches. He's actually in the BBC's top 100 greatest Britons as well. Max, I don't recall seeing him on television or anything like that, but you're a little bit older than me. I'm sure you remember Enoch Powell. What are your thoughts on Enoch Powell before we begin to discuss him here?
Well, Enoch Powell was a very intelligent man. You only had to hear him speak. And when he spoke, he didn't speak boringly. He spoke in sometimes very flowery language, but it was always language which described very precisely the concept that he was trying to convey. And he obviously was somebody who had a tremendous education. Somebody who believed that the power of speech was very important, and you know, when you look back through his life, you see that he not only learned and became highly proficient, and I think he won a prize in the year that he took an exam on ancient Greek and Latin. He won the highest possible award for that particular exam. But he not only learned classical languages, he also learned Portuguese. He learned how to speak Urdu. He learned how to speak Russian. He learned so many languages. It's just amazing. And he was an amazing man. And it's just such a pity that when we see so many politicians nowadays who are... who've got second-class intellects and who can't actually grasp the reality of the situation that this country is in. It's just such a pity that a man with such a towering intellect as Enoch Powell was sidelined by corrupt politicians during his era. So therefore, we didn't benefit from having him lead the country.
So he was an absolute champion wordsmith. Apparently, he was very good at uniting the classes as well. I mean, after he gave this speech, he had all the football supporters and all the working classes that were supporting him, as well as those in the upper class. And that's quite a unique talent, that is, being able to unite all the different factions in the country. This is why it was such a shame that... he left politics, but we'll get into that later on. Let's start with a summary of his life here. John Enoch Powell, MBE, a member of the British Empire, who was born in 1912 and died in 1998, was not just a British politician with a gift for eloquent speeches, but also a classical scholar, an author, a linguist, a soldier, a philologist, and a poet. Before entering politics, Powell was a classical scholar, becoming a full professor of ancient Greek at the age of 25 in Australia. During World War II, he served in both staff and intelligence positions, reaching the rank of brigadier in his early 30s. He was also a poet, with published works as early as 1937, as well as an author writing many books on classical and political subjects. He served as a Conservative Member of Parliament from 1950 to 1974, where he was Minister of Health between 60 and 63, and later was an MP for the Ulster Unionist Party from 1974 to 1987. Powell attracted widespread attention following his 20th of April 1968 address to the general meetings of the West Midlands Area Conservative Political Centre, which became known as the Rivers of Blood speech. It criticised the then much lower rate of immigration into the UK, especially from the new Commonwealth, and opposed the then proposed anti-discrimination legislation, the Race Relations Bill. In response, Conservative Party leader Edward Heath sacked Powell from his position as Shadow Defence Secretary in the Conservative opposition. The speech was immediately considered by the press as a blatant demonstration of racism and drew sharp criticism from his own party as a result. In the aftermath of the speech, several polls suggested that between 67 and 82% of the UK population agreed with Powell's opinions. And still today, he is remembered as one of the top 100 greatest Britons, according to a poll conducted by the BBC. His supporters claim that the large public following which Powell attracted helped the Conservatives to win the 1970 general election, and perhaps cost them the February 1974 general election, when Powell turned his back on them by endorsing a vote for Labour, which returned as a minority government in early March following a hung parliament. Powell was returned to the House of Commons in October 1974 as the Ulster Unionist Party MP for the Northern Ireland constituency of South Down, and he stayed representing the constituency until he was defeated at the 1987 general election. And Max, just before we actually went on air today, you were telling me something about Powell's greatest failure was that he didn't actually form a party of his own. Do you want to mention that a little bit here?
Well, this was in the sort of mid-70s when Enoch Powell eventually left the Conservative Party and took up and then got himself re-elected as a member of Parliament for, I think it was one of the Ulster Unionist parties. But the point is that at that point, there was tremendous support for Enoch Powell. And as the text that you've just been reading from suggests, between 67 and 82% of the UK population agreed with Powell's opinion, which would tend to mean if you can that virtually 100% of the Conservative Party's rank and file members would have agreed with Enoch Powell, and it would have only been the parliamentary Conservative Party and this small nucleus of people around Edward Heath that actually wanted Enoch Powell thrown out of the party. And so had Enoch Powell at that point announced that he was forming his own political party, then my belief is that his party would have almost immediately would have eclipsed the Conservative Party, and he would have then become a future prime minister. And it's one of the greatest sadnesses of my life that he didn't do that. He just didn't have the courage or the self-belief to do that, which is a great shame. And this country is all worse off for that fact. But amazing how different the country might have been had he been a more determined person.
He is known as the greatest prime minister that we never had. And one interesting point about this, I think, is, I mean, if they say that there was a poll and 82% of the UK population agreed with his opinions, why was the mainstream media completely against him? Why was his party completely against him? What does that tell us? It tells us that the mainstream media and the Conservative Party are completely against the population of Britain. They do not have the same goals as the population of Britain. I mean, it's just incredible to me that a man that was so popular, they would shoot down his opinions and pretend that he's the bad guy. And they've done that ever since. They still make him out to be a terrible person and a terrible racist. In actual fact, what they're doing is just condemning the population here. And since it's 82%, as you point out there, Max, it's going to have been all the Conservative Party members, but that means that it was a large amount of the Labour Party members as well. So if he had have formed a party, perhaps we would have had a credible third party and we wouldn't be in the situation that we are in today. It is a great shame that he didn't do that. Possibly it was through loyalty to the Conservatives, maybe, old-time loyalty. I mean, he'd been a member of the Conservative Party for quite some years by that time, and despite them stabbing him in the back like that, perhaps he still had loyalties to them. But it's a great shame, great shame.
I think that much of the 20th century saw a kind of internal, a civil war within the Conservative Party between what, perhaps in previous times, would have been regarded as the Whigs in one faction and the Tories in the other faction. Nowadays, the term Tory is synonymous with Conservative, but the Tories were a faction within the Conservative Party for much of the 20th century, and they were the right wing of the Conservative Party. They were passionately royalist. They were passionately pro-Parliament. They were patriotic, but they also had a sense of noblesse oblige, where they felt that it was the responsibility. It was kind of a patriarchal kind of concept, where they believed that people who were who formed the landed gentry and the aristocracy of the country had a duty to make to care for the needs of the working people. And there was, at the same time, simultaneously within the Labour Party, They were what I describe as patriotic working class people that would have supported Robert Blatchford, who was one of the founding fathers of the Labour Party and who eventually joined the Conservative Party and joined the Tory side of the Conservative Party. And there have been points during the 20th century when the Tory right of the Conservative Party has forged a connection with the patriotic left of the Labour Party. And I would say that the closest we've come to that in recent times has been the support there was for Nigel Farage in the referendum struggle, and also to a lesser degree that the situation that we've had in more recent times where Boris Johnson has tended to represent the right wing of the Conservative Party, and yet he still had an appeal with the patriotic elements within the Labour Party, so that he was able then to win the red wall constituencies during the last general election, and so therefore getting himself elected with a thumping great majority. So there always has been this kind of connection, and it's just a pity really that the politicians who have benefited in those on those occasions haven't just gone that bit further and taken the steps to turn back all the things that are going wrong with this country. And this is where the Conservative Party, as people have said on so many occasions, have failed to actually conserve anything of any real value. And all they tend to do is to maintain the status quo and then win the more avaricious and money-focused elements within the Conservative Party, what would have been regarded as the Whigs in times gone by, where those people who tend to play to the tune of international capitalism and international finance, those sort of people have then sort of wrecked the country. And so it's just a great pity that we haven't had a leader that's been able to create a coalition of the patriotic right and the patriotic left and put the country right again.
Would you say then that the Whigs were the ones that were just trying to capitalise on whatever way things were going, and the Conservatives wanted to conserve things? Would that be a correct way to describe these Whigs?
Yeah, the Whigs would have been the merchant classes. They would have been the people who would have, during the 19th century, be regarded as, and the early 20th century, be regarded as the sort of nouveau riche. They were the people who were self-made men who'd made a lot of money out of banking, who'd made a lot of money out of international trade, and also that they were the people that made the most money out of the empire as well, actually, as it turns out. But they made that money, and then of course that they didn't want to then be prevented from exercising the power that their wealth gave them. They didn't want to be prevented from doing that by social convention. They didn't want to be prevented from doing that by the fact that the aristocracy and the monarchy in those days wanted to keep the nation strong and prioritise keeping the nation strong over facilitating the further enrichment of those merchant classes.
Well, so I mean, the way that seems to explain it to me is that today the majority of them are Whigs, but they're actually called Tories. I think so the only genuine Tory that there is today is probably Jacob Rees-Mogg, who does tend to have a sense of noblesse oblige, but unfortunately it was his father in the Times that really went for Enoch Powell and slammed him with his newspaper The Times, and we noticed that Jacob Rees-Mogg still does the same today, it's a great shame, really, that none of them will actually speak up for him, because if some of them would, then I think they would gain a lot of the support that Enoch Powell actually had, and none of them had a backbone. None of them will actually speak up for him. They all say that he was, you know, the devil incarnate. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, if one of them would actually stand up and speak for him, then I would have thought it would be Jacob Rees-Mogg. But no, he travels in his father's footsteps, basically, and refuses to honour the man. Well, let's look at his early life then. John Enoch Powell was born in Stechford, Worcestershire, on the 16th of June 1912 to parents of Welsh descent. He lived there for the first 6 years of his life before his parents moved to King's Norton in 1918, where he lived until 1930. He was the only child of Albert Enoch Powell, a primary school headmaster, and his wife Ellen Mary, who was the daughter of Henry Breeze, a Liverpool policeman. His great-grandfather was a coal miner, and his grandfather had been employed in the iron trade. So he's got quite a working-class background there, a fairly intelligent father, was a headmaster, and his mother, the daughter of a policeman, so understood law and order. So really working class, really, but with a higher than average IQ, I would say, that he was inherited from his father, primary school headmaster. Powell read avidly from a young age, and as early as three, he could read reasonably well, being nicknamed the Professor by his family because he used to stand on a chair and describe the stuffed birds his grandfather had shot, which were displayed in his parents' home. Though not wealthy, the Powell family were comparatively comfortable financially, always having enough money for books, and their home included a library. Powell was heavily influenced by the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, but it is not known how early he first came across him. He first went to King's Norton Grammar School for Boys before moving to King Edward's School, Birmingham, where he studied the classics and was one of few pupils in the school's history to attain 100% in an end-of-year English examination. He then studied at Trinity College, Cambridge from 1930 to 1933, during which time he fell under the influence of the poet A.E. Hausmann, then the professor of Latin at the university. He also began to study German at this time, as many of the most prominent classics scholars were German. Strangely, he took no part in politics at university. While studying at Cambridge, Powell became aware that there was another classicist who signed his name as John U. Powell, and deciding to distinguish the other man's work from his own, Powell decided to use his middle name instead of his first, and from that moment on always referred to himself as Enoch Powell. While at university, in one Greek prose examination lasting 3 hours, he was asked to translate a passage into Greek. Powell walked out after just 1.5 hours, having produced 2 translations, one in the style of Plato and the other in the style of Thucydides. For his efforts, he was awarded a double-starred first in Latin and Greek, this grade being the highest possible and extremely rare. As well as his education at Cambridge, Powell took a course in Urdu at the School of Oriental Studies because he felt his long-cherished ambition of becoming Viceroy of India would be unattainable without the knowledge of an Indian language. Other languages he learned included Welsh, in which he jointly edited a medieval legal text, modern Greek, and Portuguese. And later on we'll learn that he also learned Russian. I mean, that's incredible, producing 2 translations, one in the style of Plato and the other in the style of Thucydides. I mean, that is incredible. And then walking out after just half the amount of time that he actually had to spend on that, and 100% in his end-of-year English examination. This is a very, very intelligent man specialising in language, who started out really, you know, just working class, basically. But he had this idea that he wanted to be Viceroy of India, and it must have been possible for him to actually get there, or he wouldn't have had a dream like that. I mean, this was the thing with the British Empire. You could work your way up from working class to upper class. Yes, it might rely upon meeting an aristocrat along the way. But as you were saying, Max, because these aristocrats, they had this noblesse oblige, they would feel obliged to help somebody that was very intelligent, and they would give them a leg up on the ladder, as it were. I was talking with Dr. Edward Dutton, Professor Edward Dutton, the other day, and he was saying, well, it was all about who you know rather than what you know, but the who you know, the who you came across, would feel obliged to help somebody if they showed above average intelligence, and would help them out with business contacts and all the rest of it. So it would have been possible for him to have become Viceroy of India if we hadn't lost India when we lost the British Empire. Max, you got any comments you want to make on his early life here?
Just to sort of reiterate again the fact that he was a brilliant scholar, and also somebody who, unusual for somebody of his age, had a clear vision of what he wanted to do later in life. Because so many people nowadays, because there aren't the opportunities that used to exist in times gone by, many people reach university and drift through university and come out the other end and still have got no clear idea of what they want to do with their lives, because there just aren't the avenues that are really thrilling and motivational to inspire them. Also, I mean, as far as Powell is concerned, he was during his early life a great supporter of the British Empire, and obviously that's why he wanted to be Viceroy of India, which I think was regarded by most people as being the most colourful and eventful part of the British Empire in terms of the potential for the empire to go on to future greatness. It was, you know, the focal point of the empire, apart from, of course, Britain herself. But once Enoch Powell became aware of the fact that as a result of World War II, we had lost the wherewithal, we had lost the certainly the political will from most of the government at that point to actually hold on to the empire, that was the point where Powell's interest in the empire started to wane.
Yeah, it's a great tragedy that we lost that empire, and he was really cut up about it when it actually happened. But again, that's a little while into the future yet. In 1937, he was appointed Professor of Greek at the University of Sydney at age 25, failing in his aim of beating Nietzsche's record of becoming a professor at 24. And I don't know much about these grades, but I'm guessing that's a very young age to become a professor. I'm not even sure what qualifications you have to actually become a professor. Is it like studying for a degree, or is it something that is bestowed upon you, Max? Do you know?
I think you just need to be appointed as a professor by a university. Right. That's really what it amounts to. You leave university as a graduate. You can do postgraduate studies, which I believe that Powell did. And I think he was a fellow of the college that he went to in Cambridge. But I think it's then just really a matter of somebody regarding your postgraduate studies as being such that it justifies you being appointed a professor so that you can share your knowledge with new students.
Oh, amazing. That's quite a credit to him to have become a professor at 24. Soon after arrival in Australia, he was appointed curator of the Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney, where he stunned the vice chancellor by informing him that war would soon begin in Europe and that when it did, he would be heading home to enlist in the army. By the time Powell had left King Edward's School in 1930, he had confirmed his instinctive belief that peace was merely temporary and that the UK would soon be at war with Germany again. So he had that idea back all the way back in 1930. He was not happy with Prime Minister Chamberlain averting war with Hitler, as he saw it as a betrayal of the national interests. And after Chamberlain's first visit to Adolf Hitler at the Berchtesgaden, he would write in a letter to his parents on the 18th of September 1938, "I do here in the most solemn and bitter manner curse the Prime Minister of England for having accumulated all his other betrayals of the national interest and honour by his last terrible exhibition of dishonour, weakness and gullibility. The depths of infamy to which our accursed love of peace can lower us are unfathomable." In another letter to his parents in June 1939, before the beginning of war, Powell wrote, "It is the English, not their government, for if they were not blind cowards, they would lynch Chamberlain and Halifax and all the other smarmy traitors." At the outbreak of war, Powell immediately returned to the UK, but not before buying a Russian dictionary, since he thought Russia would hold the key to our survival and victory, as it had in 1812, and 1916. So he certainly seems ahead of the curve here in both points, understanding that there was going to be another war with Germany. Of course, that was set up by the Versailles Peace Treaty, and the terms of that pretty much guaranteed there was going to be another war. And here he understood that it was going to rest on what happened with Russia. And I do find it a little bit of poetic justice that he's obviously got an anti-Hitler mentality, and he would have got that from the mainstream media, and he obviously believed the mainstream media, as most people did back then. And when it came to his time in the limelight, in the glare of the mainstream media, they cursed him, and he got the back end of it. So there was a bit of justice there. Is there anything on that you want to pick out and comment on, Max?
I was just sort of agreeing with the irony of that situation, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I guess that's the word, isn't it? Irony. Well, I think we've got enough time to get into a little bit of his military service, the start of his military service here. During October 1939, almost a month after returning home from Australia, Powell enlisted in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. Rather than waiting to be called up, he had claimed to be Australian. As Australians, many of whom had travelled to Britain at great expense to join up, were allowed to enlist straight away. In a poem, he wrote of men joining the army like bridegrooms going to meet their brides. But his biographer points out that it is unlikely that many other men shared his joy, particularly not those who were actually leaving actual brides behind. Powell was commissioned on the general list in 1940 after answering the question of an inspecting brigadier with a Greek proverb, but almost immediately transferred to the intelligence corps. He was soon promoted to captain and posted as GS-03 Intelligence to the 1st and later the 9th Armoured Division. During this time, he taught himself the Portuguese language in order to read the poet Camoá in the original language. As insufficient Russian-speaking officers were available at the War Office, his knowledge of the Russian language and textual analysis skills were used to translate a Russian parachute training manual, a task he completed after 11 p.m. in addition to his normal duties, deducing the meaning of many technical terms from the context. On one occasion during this time, he was arrested as a suspected German spy for singing the Horst Wessel lead and was sent to the Staff College, Camberley. So I think what we can take from this is, I mean, this is an incredibly intelligent man, and yet he's still desperate to join up with the army and to give his life for his country. So he's incredibly patriotic, and that gives us an idea of the mentality of most of the people back then. Imagine flying back from Australia just so that you could join up with the army because you're so desperate to join, and lying about your citizenship and saying you are Australian just so that you can actually join the army and give your life for your country. I mean, I doubt whether there's anybody in Britain today that would be like that, that would be so desperate to give their lives for their country. And yet that was the love that people had back then for their nation, for their country, and for their king. Is there anything you want to pick out on this bit, Max, and comment on?
Just that I think that lots of young men during that period would have looked back in over what to them would have been quite recent history, the latter part of the 19th century. They would have seen the opportunities that existed through the forging of the British Empire, and so therefore for a young man it probably would have been, there would have been sort of romantic associations between sort of combining proving your worth as a man and also being of service to your country and risking your life in order to make your own fortune and in order to make your own nation and the empire to which you belong stronger. And in that respect, Enoch Powell would have been very similar to what Enoch Powell sort of says, or what's written about him here, is reminiscent, really, of the kind of things that that Hitler kind of said to himself during the sort of early post-First World War period, where he wished to become German and wished to join the German army so that he could again help to expand the German Empire and make his fortune that way as well. So I suspect that lots of young men had similar kind of romantic notions without necessarily thinking too seriously about the grimmer side of warfare. I know that as far as my own father was concerned, you know, he and all his brothers all went and enlisted on the first occasion they could to go and fight during the Second World War. And so I imagine that Enoch Powell was filled with the same kind of patriotic fever.
And also, when we talked about the British Empire before and the characters from the British Empire, a lot of it has been battles and wars, and there probably hadn't been that many going on since the First World War, and everything that they would have read about the British Empire would have included all these battles and wars. So it would have been idealized, I guess. So they would have wanted to do the same as their ancestors did and wanted to show the world what they were made of. Well, I think we should really leave that here now, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.